You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Oh, Don, it is so pretty out there. And it didn't get too hot this week. You surprised me. I thought we were going to have a heat wave.
I surprised you. Well, they were talking about temperatures up close to 100 degrees and just gradually backed off from that. The southwest and southern part of the valley got plenty hot, but we up here only got to about 91 degrees, I think it was yesterday, and that was the hottest day of the supposed event. So that was our heat wave, folks. Hope you enjoyed it. Temperature for the next few days are going to be absolutely, I think the term I'll use is balmy. You're going to be absolutely balmy for the next several days. Today's date, as we are preparing the show for broadcast on May 14th, is May 13th, 2026, is going to be a high today of 81 degrees. So tonight's low will be 52, Thursday will be 88 degrees, Thursday night, 54 degrees, Friday, 88 degrees, Friday night, 55 degrees, Saturday, 81 degrees, a little cloud is in the picture there, little tiny cloud, 81 degrees, sunny on Saturday, Saturday night, 57, mostly clear, and here's the big thing, Sunday, 83 and breezy. Sometimes when you see the word breezy, you might want to translate that to windy. Sunday will be 83 and breezy. Sunday night, clear with a low around 59. Monday, 88 degrees, high temperature, high pressure building, breezy again. So north wind hitting us Sunday and Monday, going to bring humidities down very, very low, which will have some advantages with respect to the many disease problems I've been seeing over the last week. But I do want to right now remind you, if you just planted little seedlings or flowers or little shrubs or trees, and it's going to be a north wind, be sure to give them a good thorough watering as we go into that windy weather. Monday will be 88 and breezy, as I said. Monday night, 57, and Tuesday, 93 degrees. And it does look like we have a warm-up going into next week. Weather Underground is talking about Tuesday being 94, Wednesday being 95, and Thursday being 93, and then cooling off dramatically again next Friday down to about 83 degrees. So there's going to be a period of dry wind, which will drop humidities significantly lower than we've been seeing here for a while. Next week, dry conditions over the Sacramento Valley, especially north of Interstate 80. Minimum relative humidity getting into the teens and upper single digits. Let me repeat that. Minimum humidity getting into the teens and upper single digits. So those are fairly close to desert-like humidities on Sunday and Monday, which brings elevated fire weather concerns for parts of the valley, portions of the delta. They will continue to monitor the model trends as they evaluate the strength of the winds and the drying effect over the valley. From a gardening standpoint, that's a substantial change. We talked about this a little bit last week when we were looking at the possibility of some very high temperatures. Those very high temperatures can stress newly planted plants. I'm not concerned about the big trees in your yard, things that are fully rooted in, that are growing. Those, you know, we've had pretty good rainfall, especially the last couple of weeks. We got a couple more storms that gave us some additional soil moisture. I'm out planting trees, and the soil moisture, by the way, is absolutely perfect for that right now. I'm not as concerned about the bigger things in the ground. I'm concerned about the little seedlings and the little 4-inch flowers that you just put in and those container plantings that you did for Mother's Day. You know, those are going to need some extra attention, especially as we get into dry, windy condition. That means the ET rate this weekend is going to be quite high compared to what we've had at least over the last several weeks.
So if Sunday and Monday are mm-hmm. the dry, windy things, then that means Saturday is soaking day.
Yeah, that's what I really like to do.
Soak your plants there on Saturday so they got lots of moisture there.
Yeah, when I see something like this coming in, I know that Friday and Saturday I'm going to be running various drip lines on my property, and they're going to be going for a long time. Depending, I'm not going to get into details of every valve, but some of them will be running for a couple of hours. Some of them will be running for 4 to 6 hours because they're larger woody plants. And I pretty soon will begin some of the 12 to 24 hour soakings that I do on some of the more established trees. I'm not there yet for those. It's May. These are they're, you know, the roots are deep and there's plenty of moisture down in the soil. But the newer planted plants, the shallower rooted plants, your turf is going to be the first thing. One thing about having a lawn that's kind of handy is if you know what it looks like when there's a little drought stress, you can tell when that part of the soil, the top foot roughly, has begun to dry out. Your turf will look duller. You walk across it, doesn't spring back up behind you as you walk across it, then that turf is a little bit drought stressed. Well, that's the area of soil I'm concerned about for the next week or two, is the top foot or so of soil. The place you just put in those little tomato plants, the place that you just put those peppers in yesterday because it finally seemed warm enough. Close watch on the watering on those. What I do with them, and I have a number of things I've just put in over the last week. I hand water them individually, so I know that the nursery soil is still getting watered and the little area around it is getting watered. There's a drip line on them that I then turn on, excuse me, after I've hand watered the individual plants, and I let it run for an hour. So each plant gets watered where it needs to be watered, and then the soil below is getting a good soaking as well. And I definitely will be doing that on Friday, if we're going into hotter weather for the weekend. KDRT is 21 years old. We're having our 21st anniversary spring fundraiser. Got to say that right. Fundraiser. We're having our 21st anniversary fundraiser this spring. We want you to help us celebrate more than 2 decades on the airwaves. There's an amazingly eclectic array of music programs. I urge you to head over to look at the schedule guide, and I'll just mention Hawaiian music, folk music, music of the Grateful Dead. The only that I'm aware of jug band radio program anywhere in the United States dedicated entirely to jug band music. There's a phenomenal world music show. That's just some of the very specialized ones, and there are some great eclectic programming on there as well. KDRT is one of those radio stations you can pretty much leave on all through the day. You'll hear very interesting music and talk shows. If you like that, if you like the idea of public radio, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button during our spring fundraiser. We appreciate your donations in the past. We would certainly appreciate your help right now during this fundraising drive. And as always, thanks for listening to KDRT.
All right, so Don, I don't want to read this part. This is depressing. Disease issues this week. Leaf
Okay.
spots on pears, leaf spots on walnuts,
I'll do
golf.
this part. I so on Sunday, I wrote this down. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, this is what I had dealt with. Several cases of leaf spots on pears, Entomosporium leaf spot fungus. Similar leaf spot on walnuts, not the same disease, but the exact same pattern. Galls caused by little blister mites on pecans and elms, and I have those on my own property as well. Yellowing leaves of a Meyer lemon. Well, we answer that question like every 2 weeks. Dieback of one branch on an otherwise healthy lime tree. Late blight on the leaves of a tomato plant. Powdery mildew on a climbing rose. Something that looked very much like verticillium wilt killing one side of a Chinese pistachio tree, and bark exfoliation and significant trunk injury from sunburn on a maple tree. And that was, I'd only been there for an hour or two that day when all these things came through. The point I want to make on this is that when we have periods, high rainfall, high humidity, and moderate temperature, you are going to see disease problems. Many of these, for example, the leaf spot fungus on pears, the spores splash. They splash in the rain, so that was there. We had two rainstorms a week or so apart where there was enough rainfall for the spores to splash. If it was much colder, it would have been too cold for those spores to infect. Been much hotter and drier, they would have simply died as soon as they landed, but we weren't. We're in that perfect in-between stage. It's like, okay, the perfect temperature range, the perfect moisture range. And we had infection of several different disease problems. We're kind of out of fire blight at the moment, but leaf spot problems. People walk in, I'm happy to walk them through the life cycle of the disease and explain the damage it's going to do. And then the usual question is, so what do I do? There is nothing to be done about most of these. We don't have effective fungicides for trees, nor would it be practical for you to spray a tree in any way for a fungus problem. Most of them, notice you haven't had this problem that much before. I went back in my records, for example, for Entomosporium leaf spot fungus on pears, 2019. In 2011, we had significant outbreaks. We talked about it on the show. That's where I found the information about them. So if you go way back, you'll find us having talked about them back then. It means that in each of those years, at this time of year, roughly, we had exactly the right combination of moisture and temperature that caused infection. It was really bad in 2019 to the point that leaves were dropping all over the place from Pyrus kawakami, somewhat from Pyrus calarion, a little bit from the common European pears and so forth, and some other related plants like Raphiolepis. People were just freaking out. They thought the plants were going to die from this. It was a lot of leaf drop. All you could do was rake it up, throw those leaves out, and wait, because dry wind, higher temperatures will put a stop to the infection. It'll run its course, and that'll be that. There's no treatment, and this is frustrating to people because it used to be if you walked into a nursery and you had a problem, you'd walk out with a product. There are places where there's a possibility they'll try and sell you a product for these things. Any fungicide that home gardeners are buying nowadays, almost everyone I can think of, are preventative. So if you walk into me with a leaf that has a disease, you can't do anything now. If you were going to spray for it, you would have sprayed on a preventative basis, much as they do with orchards, for example. If you had been spraying your Pyrus kawakami, I suppose, with copper of some sort during the winter and the early spring, you might have prevented this to some degree, but I don't really think so with this particular disease. Most important thing to know is most of these have a very limited time duration, a very narrow range of infection, a predictable disease cycle that will cause predictable outcomes, and they aren't life-threatening to the plant. I should say, they're not going to kill the tree. Rake up a lot of leaves? Sure, it's not great for the tree to lose 10, 20, even 30% of its leaves. But as long as new growth is coming on, you water it correctly, give it the basic care it needs, then you really don't have to worry about the disease. And by the time you see it, it's too late to spray, even if there was a spray material that you could use. And nor do you have a sprayer that's going to spray up into a 30-foot tree. I just don't see the practicality of this. So just be aware of it. We go through these cycles. Every few years, we'll have just the right conditions for a particular disease problem to be unusually bad this year, and it'll be several years before that happens again. It's that timing of the rain and the temperature that we had when that rainfall occurred that led to these disease outbreaks. As we've joked in the past, when you have that kind of weather, it's great fungus weather. It's perfect for fungus. And as home gardeners, we get all freaked out. But for the most part, if it's a plant that grows here, it's probably not going to be a life-threatening thing. This isn't anything new. It's not something we've never seen before. And we know what the outcome is likely to be. And the plant will simply outgrow it. They outgrow fire blight. They outgrow leaf spot diseases. They outgrow peach leaf curl. They outgrow brown rot. Of all of those ones I just mentioned, the one that would affect your crop would be the brown rot, which is one of the reasons you do spray apricots, plums, peaches, and so forth during the winter, the late winter or the early bloom season. And I have seen some cases of brown rot, and I have seen some cases of shot hole fungus affecting the fruit of apricots already. It'll just be a rough year for your apricot, but I don't have a practical solution to that except to maybe mark your calendar for next winter to do a dormant spray if you think you're going to have the problem again. These mostly are predictable and mostly are not all that harmful. They're just kind of ugly and you just have to deal with them for a couple of weeks.
Well, Don, we have a whole bunch of things that came in on the email. And if someone wants to send us an email, where do they send it?
Well, that would be davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
And if you do send us an email, please include where you are.
Well, that's helpful, yes.
It makes a difference in the advice that Don gives out, whether he knows if you're in a desert or you're in a jungle or you're in the coast or you're in Davis. You know?
There's some questions that are universal, but some of them it's really important to know where you're writing from. Is it time to plant tomatoes in Montreal yet? I just want to put that out there for our friend in Canada. I don't think so from what I'm seeing, but let us know.
So this is from Ben in SoCal.
Okay.
And he is writing about a Chico Zapote, whose Latin name is Manilcara Zapota.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but it's a tree and it's got leaves.
very good.
I'm looking at it and it's like, well, I can't describe the fruit or the flower because it's not fruiting or flowering.
Okay, but hold on here. Zapote is a subtropical fruit. And I know it just because I happen to, you know, grow up in Southern California. It is a pretty big tree, honestly. And we can't grow them up here. They aren't hardy enough to grow in Northern California. Every time I say that, I know someone out there is going, wait, no, I have a friend who has one. If you're interested in subtropical fruit that are not technically considered hardy in our climate, you should go to the California Rare Fruit Growers Facebook page or even their online library of the documents they put out in the 1960s and 70s and 80s on all these different subtropical species. And if there's one variety that's hardier, you will find mention of it there. So when people come in asking me about cherimoyas or sapotes or things like that, and of course, we're in USDA Zone 9 or in Sunset Zone 14. It's not, we can't grow them here. It's too cold in the winter for those. Except there's probably one that you can, or there's some guy in Woodland perhaps who has one next to his garage and can tell you exactly what he's done. So sapote is a big tree. It's a subtropical fruit. I've tasted them. They're delicious, sweet, not a lot of tartness to them. They're one of those kind of softer textured sweet fruit. And I remember my father trying to grow one in coastal San Diego where he didn't get enough heat for it. So it's one of those plants. It's a Southern California specialty, in my opinion. There's probably one that grows up here in Northern California. If you're up here and you know of one, DavisGardenShow@gmail.com. I love a picture and a cultivar name if you happen to have one.
All right. So he says, this sapote was planted about 1 year ago, never grew much, and has never looked vibrant. It was a fairly large air-layered branch.
Yeah.
Roughly its current size, 4 feet wide and fan-shaped, in a 10-gallon pot with what you might call a nascent root system at the time that he planted it. Yeah. Within a week of planting, the leaves lost their gloss and the tree looked stressed all summer, yep, including scorched leaves, despite my efforts to keep it well-watered.
I would have shaded this young tree at the time of planting. And the only, I don't typically recommend that or consider it crucial, but in this particular case, I would have done that because you had a relatively minimal root system. Air layering is like taking a cutting. Air layering is where you essentially make a cutting on the plant. You have a tree and you wrap some moss or something around a slight slit that you've put in beneath a node. You wrap that with moss. You wrap the moss with either plastic or mesh of some kind, and you make sure it stays moist but not soggy until the plant roots. Sometimes people figure out some way to get rooting hormone into this process as well. It works really well on some things, doesn't work at all on others, but it's harmless to try it typically because you just try it and see, and if it roots, great, and if not, no harm, no foul, as they say. But an air layered branch, the root system would nowhere near be big enough to support the top, especially going into the summer. So it, keeping it in a container in a slightly sheltered location would probably have avoided the yellowing and the leaf drop that you went through because of that transplant shock. Shading it a little bit would have probably helped. This is a case where continuing to shade it for a little while might not be a bad idea. Putting a few stakes around it and putting some, say, 30 to 50% shade cloth over it, especially, I don't remember exactly where in Southern California you are, but if you're in the interior, you can get just as hot as we do here, and it can be very low humidity when that happens, so the plants can get pretty stressed. So light shade on this young tree for another season might not be a bad idea, particularly through this summer. I think that may be a whole lot of what you're seeing on this, because it doesn't look that unhealthy. It just looks like it's struggling to establish. The other thing I'm concerned about, and I'm really glad you sent this picture, it looks like it's planted a bit too deep. And so I think it would be, and this is a challenging thing to deal with after the fact, but I would pull away the mulch that I can see, and I would probably take that plant that I see planted at the base of this, and I would move that one at least a couple feet away, pull away the mulch and look. And if your root flare is buried, this plant will always struggle. You are watering thoroughly. I can see the bubbler thing there. So the water is basically getting to where it needs to for this young plant. But I would also note, as it, and these are very similar to pictures I often see here, it's bare soil all around it, all the way around this. I don't see any other landscaping within 2 to 3, 4 feet of this plant, which is good. You don't want anything competing with it, but that means you're probably not watering the soil around it either. So its roots will have a great deal of difficulty spreading out into the nearby soil because roots won't grow into dry soil. So I would widen your watering zone and get down there and check and see if you can see the root flare. And I would probably just go ahead and leave that open, get the mulch a little further away from the plant, because my recollection is that sapotes are pretty vulnerable to root and crown rot. So I want you watering deeply, which I believe further description tells us he has been doing, but I also think you need to water wider. And so I see one bubbler here. You might just add another one or a ring of irrigation about 2 feet out so that when you're watering close to the plant, you're also watering further away from the plant. Those are the two things I would do right now. Check the root flare and widen your watering zone, and also consider some afternoon shade on this plant.
So Don said it was bare dirt. It's actually bare mulch.
Right. Sorry. Yeah. Bare dirt covered with mulch, which is better than bare dirt, but it doesn't look like this. But I see what I see irrigation lines like this, where it's a quarter inch line or smaller coming to the plant from the main supply line. Typically in those irrigation settings, people are just watering the zone of the plant, which is fine up to a point, but it does make it difficult for those roots to get out. And most people are thinking in terms of roots going down, but bear in mind that most tree roots go out more than they go down. The vast majority of roots are in the top 12 to 18 inches of soil, and it's important to widen your watering zone as trees grow. And I think that would have reduced some of the stress that you're seeing here. Most of it, I think, is simply the ratio of top to root that you had when you were starting. And so over time, I think this will outgrow it. But a little protection on this plant while it's getting going would be good. I see what looks like new growth. So I think you're on the right track. I think it just went through a tough year last summer.
So if someone were planning to do one of these air layering things, and he said it was about the size of what it is, what we see in the picture now. When you got, questions on air layering. Would you have left the roots growing longer before you disattached it to the tree? Or would you have trimmed off some of the leaf things so that the roots could establish without trying to support all that?
Well, leaving it on there wouldn't be good. Once it's rooted, it's probably filled the air layering unit to capacity. You can buy little devices for this purpose. They're kind of fun to look at, little things you just clip on that do the air layering for you. They probably filled that. So my guess is that that was at capacity. Trimming the top, well, the old idea of pruning the top to bring it into balance with the roots, we know that that was a bit of a myth. That goes all like when you buy a bare root fruit tree. The first one I bought, the guy cut it in half and said, that's to bring the top and the roots into balance. And my hort professors, when I came to college, said, well, that there's no basis for that. But it's a sort of a logical thing people seem to think follows. You cut the roots to do the bare root, therefore you're cutting the top, you bring them in balance. The more leaf area, the faster the roots will establish. So cutting the top back is not generally beneficial. Let's put it that way. The more of the top you can leave, the better. The downside of that is the plant will come into its own balance by a simple process. It'll shed some older leaves, which is exactly what happened here. And it'll often stop the new growth, which doesn't appear to have happened here. If the new growth stops, you've got a problem. Shedding older leaves, less of a problem. Now, reading quickly through here about how much water he's giving a good deep soaking. About 6 weeks ago, I switched to a spray bubbler that delivers about 7 gallons an hour times 4 hours once weekly. So this plant's getting 28 gallons of water once a week. Probably doesn't need that many gallons, but the once a week thing I do like to see because he's in a clay loam soil, and I think it will retain moisture and it reduces the risk of root or crown rot. That's just on the edge of not often enough. So if you have a heat wave, you have a Santa Ana wind or something that comes along and really dries things out, you might go 5 days instead of seven before your next irrigation, or you might just do a second one in the middle.
One of the things that is in his picture is one particular clump of leaves is covered in what he is calling kissing bugs.
Yep.
Are they kissing bugs?
Nope. This is a great picture. Those are leaf-footed bugs. And it's a fantastic picture of leaf-footed bugs because it shows several stages of the insect, including adults that have the I call them flanges on the legs, the thing that make it look like a leaf on the leg. It also has earlier larvae, nymphs, that do not have those on the legs and are a different color, but it's the exact same beast. 4 nymph stages before the adult, I think I have that right, and each one is slightly visibly different than the other. Leaf-footed bugs are native to California. We have 3 species in the state of California that very happily moved on to many of our ornamental and crop plants when we all came here and started planting things. They're a big problem on almonds, for example. They can damage a couple of a percent of the almond crop. This little insect here can be up to 5% of the crop. I remember reading that at one point. I'm on all the email listservs for almond growers and walnut growers because I have been both of those things. And as soon as these guys show up in the southern San Joaquin Valley, the alert goes out to almond growers. Get out and monitor your orchards and start spraying. You homeowners don't need to spray for these, but they can be startling when you come across, how many are there in this picture? 30, 40 of them in this picture, something like that, all in one place on a plant. They are a congregating type of bug, sort of a squash bug-like thing. And so it's less common to find one or two than it is to find this kind of thing where you have an entire population of them. They can do a little bit of damage to fruit. they really don't damage the plant itself in any particular way. They can do a little damage to peaches and nectarines, for example. If this quantity were on a peach tree near one fruit, a bunch of them would poke their proboscis in and that fruit would be all nubbly and wouldn't develop properly. Same thing with tomatoes occasionally. When they poke their proboscis into the fruit of either of those later in the season, you don't even notice it. You'll see a slight yellow area on a tomato. You'll see a slight discolored area on a peach or a nectarine. Other than that, the fruit looks fine. Most of you have eaten those without even knowing that a leaf-footed bug had been there earlier in the season. The damage they do is particularly to pomegranates and almonds. With almonds, they land on them about now. They poke their proboscis in, which is powerful, into the nut, the meat part of the nut, which is still soft. They insert a little enzyme that essentially liquefies that, and they suck down the almond juice, the almond milk, you might say. Very good nutrient source for them. And that leaves the grower with an empty almond, and that falls off. And as I say, anywhere from 2 to 5% of the nuts can be damaged if they have a bad infestation of leaf-footed bugs. So they would spray for it. You don't particularly need to do that. And on pomegranates, they can poke, believe it or not, through the skin of the pomegranate into the arils, which is the little red juicy part that you are growing it for, and suck that right on down. And they can do another one and another one. So you go in and you open up that pomegranate, or it splits open when we get to the harvest season of October to early November. And sometimes, as they've been poking their proboscis in, they've inadvertently introduced a spoilage organism, and you open it up and it's gross on the inside. If you've got a normal pomegranate tree, we're talking about one or two fruit on a tree that might have 200. So it's not like you don't have enough to share, but it is something that can happen. And pomegranates are one of the places we commonly find leaf-footed bugs. In fact, they're one of the most common places they overwinter, because pomegranates hang there. You never pick them all. You've got 200 pomegranates. How many did you eat last year? And they split open and a lot of that rots out. They enjoy that. Rats come in and eat that part, and they just crawl right in there and hang out there for the winter. So they often overwinter in pomegranates and on pomegranate trees. So that's one place, if you're having a problem with leaf-footed bugs, to look for them. There are sprays for them, but I'm not going to mention them because it's not necessary. It is absolutely not necessary to spray for leaf-footed bugs. On my property, I watch as jays and mockingbirds take these off. If you find one on a plant, just flick it off out into the open, pretty much guarantee something will come along and eat it. If you have a whole bunch of them in one place, it's grossing you out, like they're all on one pomegranate, you really wanted to harvest that fruit, take a shop vac. They're pretty dumb animals. Go out and vacuum them up. They literally will not fly away as you do this. Be sure to put a plastic bag over the end of the vacuum cleaner and seal that on with a rubber band and put that back in your garage, where they will then die in the vacuum cleaner. Because if you just move the vacuum cleaner with them in there, they'll fall right back out. So you can vacuum them up very effectively with a shop vac or even a little handheld. What is that? Dust devil or something like that. So mechanical control. Another technique I've heard is bucket of soapy water, hold it under them, shake the plant. They literally will fall down into the water and drown. They're pretty easy to control and they really don't do that much damage. So no, they are not any part of your problem on here, but it's good that you've seen these now, just in case you happen to have fruits nearby. They're not kissing bugs. That was the question. I think this bunch of kissing bugs might be helping in some way. No, they're not helping the plant in any way, although they're not particularly harming the plant. And kissing bug is a different insect that looks somewhat similar. Kissing bugs and assassin bugs are closely related. Assassin bugs are much more common and are beneficial in the landscape. Kissing bugs can injure people, but they're not common. And so I don't want people seeing assassin bugs to assume that they have kissing bugs. I realize this is getting off into the weeds here, but kissing bugs is not a common name for these. These are leaf-footed bugs. And there was a question about fertilizer. Something about nitrogen. He said he had applied. Of note, I also gave it a nitrogen fertilizer just before the weather turned cold several weeks ago. The nitrogen was fine. Actually, early spring is a good time to fertilize young plants. I would use some kind of soluble, relatively gentle fertilizer on something that's been transplanted like that. I don't remember what he used, but I would say something like fish emulsion. Organic soluble fertilizers are great. If you like conventional fertilizers and the plant is a little stressed like this and doesn't have as much of a root system, I would take a conventional one and use it maybe half strength. And early in the season is fine. Early in the season, this is a minor hair splitting here, but early in the season is not great for conventional fertilizers, because by the time the plant is growing and would make use of them, they may well be out of the root zone. You might have had enough subsequent water to just move them through the root zone, so they wouldn't have been taken up as readily. Organic fertilizers in the soluble form tend to stay in the root zone better. They do, however, have to break down. They have to go through a three-step process before most plants can take them up. So you apply them in, let's say, mid-March, and the plant will be showing results by mid-April. Whereas a conventional fertilizer, if the weather is right, if the plant is ready to begin active growth, you may see results in as little as 7 to 10 days. Organic fertilizers also last longer. So one feeding in the spring with a gentle organic fertilizer will generally give a seedling, a flower, a young transplanted plant what it needs for the entire spring and even perhaps the entire summer. Conventional fertilizers, despite being higher nitrogen, only typically last a month. They give faster results. They tend to give more dramatic results. That's why Miracle-Gro became so popular. Fast results and definite results. But they told you to feed with it every 3 weeks. And I don't know very many gardeners who want to do that. But any conventional fertilizer would need to be used about every month during the growing season. Whereas organic sources of nitrogen typically can be applied once a season, once every 2 to 3 months, whatever works best for you.
All right. So here's a question, and this is from a listener, Charlie, who is in New York.
Brooklyn. Hi, Charlie.
Our community garden is in a national park called Floyd Bennett Field. It's near Staten Island. And so they planted this bed of garlic. It's about 7 to 9 feet long and 2 feet wide. It looks to be in an animal trough of some sort.
Yeah, raised planter.
Yeah. And then they weren't sure what was going to happen, if the place would be shut down or whatever. So it's been a while. They planted in September of 2025. It's now May. And Charlie's question is, now that they're almost ready, because they were planted 2 months ago, do you think I need to give my garlic some blood meal mixed with water? So let's talk about two things. One is, blood meal doesn't dissolve, does it?
Not very readily, no. If you use blood meal, you just put it on the ground, cultivate it in, and then water overhead, and that would take care of it. By the way, just for the record, my father liked blood meal, but he found that it very much attracted skunks. And so, he would use
blood.
He would use a tablespoon of blood meal under each tomato plant. He would dig the hole, put it down the bottom, plant the tomato plant, come out the next day, find the tomato plants dug up, shoved off to the side because the skunks were going after the blood meal. So be aware that you're in a community garden. I don't know that you have a lot of skunks or other animals going through there, but that's something to be aware of. The timing, though, would concern me. We generally don't feed onion family members on the downside of their life cycle. We feed them early in the life cycle, which here would be not long after you plant them, because you put them in let's say October, and they're growing by November, and they grow through the winter. Remember where we are. Okay. So we would feed them at the time of planting, or as they begin that active growth cycle. As we get through the winter towards when they're growing out, and then you're going to be getting ready to perhaps push them over and harvest them, fertilizer can lead to rot. And it can be problematic. I'm not saying it absolutely will, but if you fed them now, I would be concerned that you might inadvertently get some rot going. So we generally don't feed at this end of the growth cycle of garlic, at least not in our area. So I would say these look great, by the way. The plants look outstanding. They're not as big as ours would be at this point, but that's because you're in a different climate. I would say they're looking good. I don't think they need any nitrogen now. Keep them watered, obviously, if you don't get the rainfall that you need. And I'd say in 6 to 8 weeks, you'll probably be ready to harvest those. They're running a little bit later. They look healthy. I would say those are a few weeks away from harvest. I would, however, since I'm an impatient kind of person when it comes to onions and garlic, I would take a trowel and poke down around at least one of them and see what's going on down there. But they don't look to me like they're ready for the process of hardening off, of ripening off to begin. Generally, as we get a little further along, maybe another 4 or 5 weeks, people will push them over, kind of bend them over, crimp them to cause the plant to sort of force it into dormancy, making it think we want it to produce those bulbs, and it will stimulate them into bulb formation. And then 3-4 weeks after doing that, you typically harvest, at least in our area. So my guess is feeding now could potentially be counterproductive. Proper watering while you're continuing the active growth, back off on the watering as we get further in closer to the harvest season. And then you'll make a decision in a few weeks about pushing them over and getting ready for harvest.
All right. Charlie actually wrote again with two other questions. I said, hi, this is my friend's garden. She came to me and said, what are these things? I told her they're Galena aphids and they're on her currants. By the way, the picture that you sent, thank you so much. I looked at that leaf and I went, I've never seen that plant before. And it's because I haven't. This is a plant that I've never actually seen, Don. It's a currant.
Yeah, we don't grow them here.
It's not the same as our ribes. This is the European currant, isn't it?
I assume so. And the currants are not grown in the Sacramento Valley because we're too dry here for them. They just fry. Mm-hmm. I have tried more than once to grow the fruiting currant. So we're jealous of the fact that you can grow currants. Great picture, because what it shows on the underside of the leaf is the exoskeleton from aphids going from one stage to the next as they molted. And yes, you have aphids present. That's what causes the distortion of the leaves. This is the kind of aphid that would be pretty easy to manage with water. Even though they're in there and the leaf is kind of curled around them, with the right kind of nozzle on the hose, you should be able to hold the branch in your hand with the leaves upside down, more or less. You know, so you're spraying the bottom of the leaf and just take some time, go over it and over it until you rinse off everything that you can see. You can blast off all those exoskeletons, that's what you'll see. But you're also washing off little eggs, which I can actually see in one of these pictures, and the earlier stages of the aphid that are still present, one of which is stuck on pretty well, so it's harder to get off. I don't see the adults. Oh, there's some adults present in this picture as well. So you'll knock all of them off. And then what we do at our nursery is we go back the next day and do it again. And we typically have learned that if we do that for 3 to 5 days in a row, even if we're not seeing any more of them, we get a very good level of control in our area. If you just do it once, well, some of those eggs will hatch. And that one stage, that one instar that's stuck on will move on to the next stage and they'll still be present. And it's likely that the adults are still landing to some degree. The winged ones are still landing to continue ovipositing. So the population is not done with the full increase, but you can get ahead of it at this point with water. And what I mean by a nozzle is the kind where you can tighten it or open it to make it stronger or looser, more of a spray, more of a jet. We want it closer to a jet. And we want you to do a sort of a sweeping action up and down. And you look at that leaf and you just wash everything off of there that you can see. This is an extremely effective way to manage aphids and whiteflies. And our pattern, as I said, is 3 to 5 days in a row until we don't see any more of them. And then you monitor. And as with all integrated pest management practices, monitoring is the absolute key. You've knocked it down. You've probably suppressed the population considerably. We know that beneficial insects will come in and finish the job to a degree. They'll come into a balance that we find acceptable in terms of the population of the pest, but that won't happen right away. So if they start to rebound because your temperature conditions are favorable for population increase of aphids, you'll have to keep spraying them off. But it's a lot simpler than going and getting a pesticide and spraying the whole thing with that. Very commonly, people come into my store telling me what they've already sprayed, then asking me to identify the pest, which is what we like to call ready, fire, aim. It's a very important principle in integrated pest management that you know what your pest is. The very first thing to do is identify the pest. Then you monitor the population to see if it's increasing. At some point, you make a treatment threshold. That's like if you're an entomologist or a farmer, but you do too. You're going, hey, there's a lot of aphids on here. This is gross. That's your treatment threshold. They would have some specific thing like count the number of aphids per leaf. I'm up to 6. That's my treatment threshold. And then you adopt the least toxic alternative for dealing with it and see if that works. Well, water is about the least toxic alternative we can think of. It's less toxic than oil, neem, Captain Jack's, all these things that people come in and tell me they've already sprayed before they knew what they were spraying for. Not every pesticide works equally well on every pest. We don't have a one-size-fits-all pesticide. Many pesticides damage beneficial insects. Some of them repel beneficial insects. That's my biggest problem with neem. It's a repellent as well as being an insecticide. And so you're spraying it on plants and you're essentially saying to the hover flies and the lace wings and the leatherwing beetles, don't come here, this smells bad. And they'll go somewhere else. And so you've reduced the ability of natural predators to give you pest management. So you use the least toxic alternative and then you monitor. And you'll move on to a stronger alternative if you have to. But that would typically be because of the likelihood of reduced yield, reduced vigor of the plant, some actual injury to the plant, not just a cosmetic thing. But the main thing is monitoring. And you did the right thing, which is you turned over the leaf and looked there, because that's where you'll find aphids, white flies, particularly the larval stages and so forth. And once you've looked at a heavy population and then you've cleaned it all off, you can watch as they start to come back. don't immediately think you need to do something, because you may find, I do frequently find, that then I notice lace wings are showing up. Then I notice leatherwing beetles are showing up. At my house, I can just leave the porch light on, and I can check by my porch light. And about 6 weeks ago, leatherwing beetles, we call them soldier beetles as well, and lace wings both started showing up around my porch light. Well, that tells me that they're out in the garden, and they're probably giving a high level of control already. Is it enough control? That's your choice. That's your call, because you have made your own treatment threshold. But as far as I'm concerned, if your treatment is vigorous rinsing with water, you don't need to worry too much about it. If it's going to be going to a pesticide, you should read the label before you even buy it. And that doesn't mean going into the store and trying to pull the label off the product on the shelf and read it there. That means take a picture of the label, go home, sit down at your computer, and find the PDF of that label. They're all online, and read all the precautionary statements and the other comments about it. Because the ones that concern me are the go-to ones these days: neem oil, spinosad, which is Captain Jack's. They do have impacts. You know, these are not benign to everything else. They're broad spectrum insecticides. So we use them if we have to, but deciding we have to should be pretty far down this process of integrated pest management. Monitor, 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 rinse, rinse, rinse. Usually that takes care of it.
And Charlie has a second question. He said, I planted this sour orange tree.
Sour cherry tree.
Sour cherry tree. Oh, yes. Thank you, Don.
Yes.
Look good.
Very different.
The graft and the root flare are above the ground.
Yep.
I learned this from Fred Yu and Ed Laivo.
Ed Laivo, yes. Worked for many years for Dave Wilson and also Four Winds Growers as a consultant. Probably knows more about fruit trees than all of us put together.
And that's where she wanted it planted. It's it's near an above ground planter.
Yeah.
I listened to the show all the time and went back to May of 2009.
Wow.
And now up to October of 2009. And I have some of my gardening friends listening as well.
We had a
great laugh when you said to Fred, you sure did not write the names on those dwarf Fred tomatoes.
Charlie sent Fred a bunch of seeds of these really cool dwarf tomatoes, part of the Dwarf Tomato Project, and they all said Fred on the label. So I assumed that was part of the name, right? Fred's growing them. We're going to give you a full report at the end of the season.
Thank you for the pictures, by the way.
Yeah.
It is a very good picture showing where the trunk enters the ground, and you can see where the graft is and where the root flare is.
Yeah.
That's a word I only recently learned, by the way.
Yeah,
and I can also see that all of the branches have been cut back in half, it looks like, and are now regrowing. So somebody decided to reduce the size of this tree.
Yeah, sour cherries are beautiful trees. It's kind of a shame when someone heads them, although in this case, they could be restored to the really lovely growth habit. They have a very different growth habit than sweet cherries. Just for the record, we don't sell any of these out here because of the spotted wing Drosophila that gets in the fruit. There are parts of the country where it hasn't arrived and may never arrive, who knows? So here they just get wormy, so we don't really sell them. But the pie cherries or sour cherries, Montmorency, Morello, there's a couple of others, are very elegant little trees. They're 15 foot roughly if you let them. They can be kept smaller with no problem, which might be handy if you do get the worm problem in terms of spraying or covering them. They're very rounded habit, whereas most sweet cherries are very strongly upright. You really don't even have to prune pie cherries or sour cherries once they're growing and getting close to mature, because their growth habit is such that you can reach most of the fruit. So most of the pruning you do is just opening them up and a little structural stuff, and they can be left alone. So it's a really lovely tree. In our climate, we would definitely recommend that you wrap this trunk with a trunk guard or paint it with interior white latex, because here we get so hot in the afternoon on a late winter day that you could get pretty serious sunburn on the bark, and cherries in particular are vulnerable to that. So you can either take it in here in our area, this might be recommended where you are, I wouldn't be surprised, take an interior white latex paint, thin it out 50-50 with water, and paint all the way up to the lowest branch. You see that done in commercial orchards to prevent sunburn. Nowadays, most of us have gone to trunk guards, which you can buy. They're either heavy paraffin-coated cardboard, or there's some kind of a plastic material that you just wrap around it up to the first branch, and then a year or so later, you take that off. Sunburn can be a huge problem on young fruit trees, particularly cherry trees. When you get sunburn on a newly planted tree, it really sets it back and oftentimes stunts it for the whole life of the tree. So if that's an issue in your area, and it could be, I would go ahead, and it wouldn't hurt to do this, paint that up to the first branch with interior white latex or wrap it with a trunk guard. Other than that, it looks great. Obviously, this, you know, little garden planter behind it will get shaded by this tree at some point. Big advantage of these raised planters, a couple people could just slide that out into a sunnier location when that happens. So it looks to me like this is well considered and well planted. Good job.
All right. And the next question we have comes from Gaina, a longtime listener in Davis. According to my research, not using AI, azaleas in pots should be fed monthly from March to August. Is that correct? I'm using a fertilizer that is specifically designed for azaleas. When it is hot weather, should I apply it in the cooler morning or does it matter? I water the plants thoroughly after applying the fertilizer. So first question I have is, are these pots inside or outside?
Well, they're outside, but yeah, some people would be growing azaleas indoors, I suppose. They're not that easy.
They're not good.
Yeah. They're sold as if they were an indoor plant, so that was is a valid question, but they definitely are not. They don't live or
it's grow. A disappointment if you try to grow them indoors. They aren't going to last very long. I've killed a couple before I figured it out.
Well,
that's a long time ago, Don.
There are hybrid azaleas that are now very popular in the florist trade because they'll pop out blooms, not just all at once in the spring, but anytime. And they can be forced into bloom for that heavy peak of bloom. So those are the ones you're typically seeing in, you know, Trader Joe's and places like that. If you take that and do it as an indoor plant, you've got a nice 4 to 6 week bouquet, and then you can decide what to do with it after that. But these are outdoors, I'm assuming. And the first question I would have is, what kind of fertilizer are you using? Because if it's a conventional, that is to say, urea, ammonium nitrate, those types of things, you probably do need to do it monthly because it's so soluble that you water it in. And then the next time you water, the part of it that's derived from urea, for example, just leach right out, go out of the pot. This is a big problem in the nursery industry. Nitrogen capture studies have shown that anywhere from 50 to 90% of the nitrogen applied to a container will just pass right through without being taken up by the plant. So nurseries are a source of pollution when they use fertilizer in that manner. If they use a fertilizer that's very soluble, such as a urea-based fertilizer, Miracle-Gro is a good example. 27 of the 30% of Miracle-Gro of the nitrogen there is from urea. Urea is a synthetic fertilizer that's very soluble. So if you put on a half inch of water after you've applied a urea fertilizer, most of it goes right out. It's not held on to by the potting soil. Ammonia is held on to some degree. Nitrate is taken up right away by the plant. So if you're using a conventional acid type fertilizer for azaleas and camellias and it says to feed monthly, you probably need to feed monthly. If you used an organic based fertilizer, it's a lot less nitrogen, so you don't get the vigorous lush growth that you would from a conventional fertilizer, but there's a higher likelihood that it will stay in the root zone as it goes through the various steps of becoming available to the plant. So if it were an organic based fertilizer, I would say once in the spring, once at the beginning of the summer, once in the early fall would be fine with a container plant. But if it's a conventional kind of buy off the shelf at most hardware stores or larger garden centers, you probably need to do it monthly. You can get back to us about which one you're using. You can, in fact, send a picture of the label, and I can tell you how those constituents break down into the different forms of nitrogen, the other things that are in there, and what makes it a special fertilizer for azaleas versus other things. Sometimes they've added sulfur. Sometimes they've made sure that the pH they'll bump up the sulfate of ammonia content, for example, just to increase the acidity. And that's something that azaleas prefer. So I'd be curious exactly what you're using. Monthly, if it's conventional, seasonally, if it's organic, would be my basic answer.
And applying it in hot weather, does it matter if you do it in the morning or not?
No, doesn't make any difference. I want to make sure it's watered before you apply it, actually. The way I do it is I water everything the afternoon before I'm going to fertilize, and I fertilize the next day, usually in the morning, but I don't think that makes that much difference. The reason for that is that watering a plant with fertilizer onto dry soil can actually cause root injury. Whereas watering onto a soil that has moisture does not typically cause that injury. Once again, organic-based fertilizer is much less likely to be a problem as far as that goes, but we prefer to fertilize onto soil that's been prehydrated. And then I don't water right after feeding because I don't want to inadvertently remove the fertilizer from the soil by having it rush right on through. So I would do it the other way around. Water first, feed the next day.
So I want to ask you about that question that you had about what's the most fragrant plant that you can think of. And I know this is top of your head, you haven't researched it.
Yeah, this is one of those open-ended questions someone asked me, and I made a point of writing it down because it seemed like a very general topic. What's the most fragrant shrub or vine we can grow here? That was actually part of the question, because there are things you can grow in more tropical climates or even in much colder areas that are perhaps as fragrant as anything we're about to mention. But off the top of my head, the five things I came up with were pretty darn random. First one's an obvious one. I thought of it because it's blooming right now. Star jasmine, Trachylospermum jasminoides, which is not a true jasmine, is in full bloom around Davis, Dixon, all around California, one of the most commonly planted plants. I do want to mention, when we're talking about fragrant plants, some things are intensely fragrant and some people find them too fragrant. And so there's going to be some of these things we'll mention where they go, oh my God, I wish people wouldn't plant that or whatever. So, you know, use some caution when you locate these perhaps. But these are considered fragrant in part because they have a lot of the volatile organic compounds that make up the scent of a flower. And in some cases, they're very volatile, meaning they drift up into the air and travel about. So you may be 40 feet away from the plant when you smell that star jasmine or whatever. If you like it, you go, wonderful. Some people go, oh God, that thing's blooming again.
So I'll put on my mask so I can get through it. Yeah.
Does that work? I don't know. That's a good question. But anyway, yeah. Star jasmine's blooming. And we answer this one a lot because people walk in and say, that probably happens once a week, do you have any jasmine plants? And we have to go through a fairly complicated discussion of what is true jasmine, what is not true jasmine, but is called jasmine, such as star jasmine. Item number one. Number two is Eleagnus, which is a group of shrubs and trees that you'd probably know if you saw them, but most people don't know their name. Powerfully fragrant. It's the kind where you're walking by 20, 30 feet away and it almost makes your eyes water. It's that kind of almost resinous, pungent, but pleasant, however, very sweet fragrance. The best known is one I don't recommend at all, Russian olive. I have one, but I don't really recommend them because it's a very invasive plant. You can smell that 30, 40 yards away from the tree when it's in bloom. It's just finished its bloom cycle. There are shrubs in the genus Eleagnus multiflora, Eleagnus ibingii, which is usually sold in the variegated form called gilt edge. Tiny, tiny flowers. It's one of these plants where you're walking by and you smell it and you can't see them. So you're looking all around trying to figure out where the fragrance is coming from. Very volatile. That is to say, the aroma compounds go into the air and drift away. So you get that fragrance all over your yard from Eleagnus as a group. The other one is Osmanthus, is very similar. It's often called sweet olive. It is related to olive. The Osmanthus that is the most fragrant has the species name Fragrans. That's easy to remember. But the other species in Osmanthus do have very fragrant flowers as well. Sweet olive is one of these fairly drab background shrubs that looks for all the world like a privet, basically, a little more open in growth habit, perfectly attractive, but not anything you'd rush out to buy just because of its appearance. It's more part of your mixed border of shrubs. In fact, that's a very good place to put one or two Osmanthus fragrans, because the fragrance, which happens mostly in the spring here, sometimes a repeat bloom in the fall, is powerful. It's another one of those where it drifts away from the plant. Most people love it. Some people might find it a little overwhelming, so I wouldn't put it right outside a bedroom window. But Osmanthus...
Is that the orange one?
The orange one is a cultivar of that. That was the first one I saw. When I first came here to go to college and I lived in the dorms, right next to us, there was a building that had one of those with the orange flower. Its official name of that cultivar is Aurantiacus, which Aurantiacus just means orange, actually. And it is a larger flower and it's showy enough that you see it, whereas the regular Osmanthus is just a pale white, so you barely see the flower. And the fragrance of the Aurantiacus is quite pungent. It mostly blooms in the fall. It's mostly a September, October bloom. The fragrance mostly blooms in the spring, but both of them are capable of popping out blooms at the alternate season. And so both of them are very fragrant and it's a wonderful smell. It's sweet olive is the common name I know for it. I've had people ask for it by a couple other common names. Very, very fragrant, easy to grow, privet-like plant as far as that goes in terms of garden usage. Cestrum, the nocturnum is the best known of the cestrum. It is called night blooming jessamine. Jessamine is just another name for jasmine. Jessamine is a common name derived from jasmine. So jasmine became jessamine, and people from the southern states often refer to something like this as a jessamine instead of a jasmine. Carolina jessamine, night blooming jessamine, just another way of saying jasmine, basically. And Cestrum nocturnum and Cestrum parqui are the two very similar members of the jessamine group that are powerfully fragrant only at night. It's one of those plants where you see the flowers, tubular, long, white flowers, not showy, but pretty enough in numbers. If you walk right up to them during the daytime, you get a very, very light fragrance from them. Just as the sun is going down, if your window is open, your whole house will be overtaken by the fragrance of this plant. My mother used to object to the one I had outside my bedroom window all the way down at the other end of the house because it would come in the window and go all through the house. And that fragrance, I loved it. But again, much like star jasmine, it was pretty overwhelming. It's a good one. I like Cestrum nocturnum. I've had it in every garden I've ever had because I think it's a wonderful plant. But I wouldn't put it right outside a bedroom window unless you really like it. One that I encountered, this will be number five, so I'll stop there. Brunfelsia americana, sometimes called Lady of the Night. And I actually gave it away because I brought this plant home in a 5-gallon container. And I set it near my front porch because I was going to plant it out there to enjoy the fragrance. I stepped outside that evening. My eyes began watering. My ears began itching. The fragrance was overpowering. And I thought, I probably shouldn't have this right outside my window. And I like fragrant flowers. So this was too much for me. So I gave it to someone who really likes fragrant flowers, who's enjoying it considerably. Brunfelsia americana, mostly zone 10, USDA zone 10, hardy enough to grow in zone 9 in a sheltered location and grown specifically for the intense nighttime fragrance. I wrote down syringa. Lilacs, of course, very fragrant.
Oh, yes.
And I wrote down privet ? Privets are closely related to lilacs. Most people don't know this. When we used to buy in lilacs in the 1980s from one grower, they were grafted onto privet rootstock. So a root sucker would come up from the lilac that would look a lot like the lilac, had fairly similar foliage, and then it would flower. I remember a customer, this is years ago, so it was quite memorable, coming in and saying, my lilac doesn't smell good anymore. It smells really weird. And I said, it's not a lilac. It's what I planted. And that was when I found out that most of the lilacs were grafted in those days onto privet. It was very hard to get them to root, apparently. Nowadays, when I get privets, excuse me, I don't usually get privets. Nowadays, when I get lilacs, they're on their own roots. They've apparently overcome the complication of propagation of privets from, again, lilacs from cuttings. Privets are easy to grow. Lilacs are more challenging to grow. And so now they're on their own roots, but they used to be grafted onto privets. And privets have a sweet, cloying, to me, very unpleasant scent. But I'll tell you, bees and butterflies do love the flowers of privets. So if you're looking for a reason not to take out that privet that you hate in your yard, at least let it bloom until the butterflies are done enjoying it, then cut it to the ground. There was one thing I follow up on, that Entomosporium leaf spot fungus. I wrote a thing on it, monograph, whatever you want to call it, with a picture, and it's uploaded at redwoodbarn.com.
So when your garden gets thin, why do you get so many weeds? Well, nature abhors a vacuum, and so do cats.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT-LP 95.7 in Davis, California. All of us here at KDRT volunteer our time to bring you music, local news, and other programming that you aren't going to find anyplace else. So please support our efforts.
Make a one-time gift now or consider a monthly donation, which helps us plan throughout the year. You can support us. It's easy. Go to kdrt.org/donate.